Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Catch with John Fisher on Blog Talk Radio, connecting life to faith.
We're just trying to get it together, trying to help their fellow man, hoping we can make it.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Blog Talk Radio, The Catch. And that comes from our website called catchjohnfisher.com. And if you are not getting The Catch, you can go to catchjohnfisher.com and sign up, and you'll receive something every morning, 5 days a week, in your email, something fresh that I write each day. And that kind of will get you familiar with us, and then you'll begin to find out that there's a lot of other things that we're doing besides just sending out an article every day. There's a bunch of other things going, and this show is one of those. And this is one of my favorite parts of what we do, because I get to get my favorite people on the phone and talk to them, where you can sit in and listen, because it's I look at it as an opportunity to expose you to some of the great people I've had the opportunity to get to know over the years. And our guest tonight is no exception by any means. In fact, I was trying to figure out how I might introduce him to you, and for some reason, I thought of, I think it's the branding that goes along with General Electric. We bring good things to life. I think that's what they say. We bring good things to life. And for some reason, I thought of that about our guest tonight, because he does that. I believe he brings good things to life. And that means he brings them to light. He helps us to see. He helps us to slow down and think and notice. Let me give you a real quick example. We're going to talk in a few minutes about artists that he has found and recorded over the years. And I was one of those. And there was a time when he brought these artists together for a weekend. And we were in, I think we were in New Mexico somewhere, and in a beautiful kind of bed and breakfast type place. And we spent the weekend, and I have to tell you, there was no agenda for this weekend. And I was kind of worried about that, and because I'd never been to that kind of thing. I've been, all the events I've been are fully planned, every hour, every minute. I figured that there was a carrot somewhere. There was some deal going to happen at the end of this thing. And no, he just got us all together to spend the weekend. And we played songs, we talked, we prayed, we laughed, we slept, we ate. And, you know, the weekend was over, and I thought, wow, you know, why don't we do more of this? Why, in all the living we do, why aren't there more moments where we just enjoy being alive and we just enjoy each other, you know? And, in this case, there were a bunch of very, very gifted, talented people, and we were able to enjoy each other's gifts and just one giving to the next. So, any rate, you're not here to hear me. You're here to hear our guests, but I wanted to give you just a little bit of a window into who he is, because He brings good things to life. Welcome, Steve West, to Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks so much, John. It's a pleasure to be with you, always.
Okay.
And that's great to be reminded of that particular weekend as well that we had together. That was a wonderful time together, to spend together that particular weekend.
It was. And one of those unforgettable experiences. And you know, maybe that is a good question. Maybe that's a good first question. Why don't we, you know, who was it? Was it T.S. Eliot that says, "Where is the life we have lost in living?" Someone, I think, and I feel like that so often, that we get so busy living our life that we don't stop to appreciate it and to enjoy it and to give gifts to each other. And you know, do you feel that, Steve?
That's very true. I think we have so little time now for reflection and just for being, you know, with people with no agenda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that weekend, for example, we didn't have an agenda really, but there really kind of was an underlying agenda, which was, hey, just spend time with each other and get to know each other and talk to each other, write some songs together and build that sense of community. That's what I was after that weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was helpful. You know, one weekend won't do it all, but you know, it was helpful.
Right.
It was a good start.
Yeah.
So we need that kind of time as people to be able to spend together in a very fast-paced environment that we can be in at times, and a very plugged-in environment that distracts us in so many ways from each other and spending time with one another. You told me once that through some of your writings that, you know, it's just a song or something comes from just sitting in one place for a long time and looking at something, you know.
That's,
I think,
true.
You talked about a song in that way. And so that kind of stuck with me, that's really what artists do. And people, if they can sit still long enough and think about something long enough, will come to a new thought oftentimes by doing that. So we need more time like that.
You're right. That actually is my personal definition of an artist is one who stays a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
With anything, you know, that's so true. Thank you for reminding me about that.
Sure.
You had Silent Planet Records. You're a lawyer. What led you to be a record company exec? And tell us a little bit about what you liked and what was and maybe didn't like about the record business.
Well, it's a very difficult business, and it's one I had from 1995 until 2004. And I didn't go looking to start a record company and didn't know a lot about how to run a record company, which probably became evident over the years, but you know, I kind of fell into it because I was booking artists for my church, and I was really fascinated with a few artists that were a part of a label called Storyville Records, which was an imprint of REX Records, which was a Christian heavy metal kind of label. And so Storyville was a singer-songwriter folk music kind of thing that was existing in the contemporary Christian music environment, which is a very strange place for it to be. And so I was just fascinated by that and started inviting some of those artists to come, one of which was Jan Christ. She was from the Detroit area. Had her to my church, was talking with her, and she just had issues with her contracts that she'd entered into. And so I just said, you know, is there a way that I can help you? And she got it back up with me later. And yes, there, you know, was a way for me to help her. Ended up finally buying her contract from Storyville. And with the idea that, well, you know, I'll buy it, then she can pay me back. It was a modest cost. She can pay me back later, or a manager can pay me back. And, well, that didn't happen. And then we thought, well, okay, well, let's do a demo record. And then the manager can shop it to some record labels. And then it was, well, let's do the record, which became Curious, the very first album we released.
Uh-huh.
And that was as far as I had gone at that point in time and wasn't necessarily planning on going any farther. But from that, I kind of became fascinated by it and the process, and thought, well, I really would like a label of musicians that are singer-songwriters, and a label that's dedicated to music that's about the true, the good, and the beautiful, you know, no matter who's making it, and no matter what the songs are about, as long as they're about what's true, good, and beautiful, you know, sort of the classic virtues, then, you know, it should be able to stand on its own in whatever environment, whether it's to Christians or to non-Christians. And so that's what I went looking for. And I found that in Jan Christ and in her music right away. And then there were others that came along later that I thought fit that bill. So that's kind of how I got started. And meantime, was working as a lawyer, hired somebody to work for me, Tony Shore, who did a great job. And, you know, eventually went half-time as a lawyer for several years, about 7 years, and then went back to work as a full-time lawyer, you know, after the label ended. So it was quite a run with 23 releases over the years and distribution into the Christian market and the mainstream market. But I can't say that it was a financial success, but it was successful in the sense of a lot of artists were supported, a lot of good music was put out there. And I think it found its audience. It just wasn't a large enough audience to make it financially successful.
Well, you know, we did, I had the privilege of working with you and, who else was it? Who put that
you
together?
You worked with David Minor.
David Minor. But I'm thinking of the Wide Angle series that we did.
Kevin Allman, a good friend of mine who's a professor at Montreat College, helped put together a radio show called Wide Angle Radio that you hosted.
Yes.
And we were able to bring some of this music on there.
And we called, I can still hear Kevin's voice, Wide Angle Radio, the best music you've never heard. why did we call it the best music you've never heard, and why was that such a good label, good thing to call it?
Yeah. Well, it was great music because, for me, that music, that music sort of resonated with, you know, so on a horizontal level, it really connected with, you know, the human condition. You know, no matter who you were, where you were, those songs really connected, I thought. I was looking for that kind of a song. But not just to leave it there. I was also looking for songs or, you know, the whole body of work of an artist that also, you know, kind of focused us vertically, but kind of pointed to something beyond just the, you know, the human condition, to something else. Folk music is great oftentimes at pointing out sort of our humanity and, you know, the different problems and issues we have. It doesn't always point outside of itself to the spiritual, you know, to a vertical dimension. And so that's what I was looking for in this music. And I just found that this was what it was. And I was very, very intrigued by that. And that's what I thought. And actually, I think that is sort of the definition of good music. You know, it does that in terms of content. And then, of course, on the other side, it's also technically as excellent as it can be, you know, as the abilities and gifts of the artist allow, and finances allow. So that's what I was interested in.
Why do you think?
And I think it didn't find enough people because, you know, I think that there's a lot of, music is marketed. There's a fairly narrow band of music in the Christian market, or at least there was at that time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it just couldn't find that audience. And then there's, it was difficult to get into the mainstream market. Now, you know, Frederick Buechner, who's one of my favorite writers, said that his books that he wrote, his novels, they were too religious for the mainstream market, and they were too worldly, you might say, for the religious market. And so he found an audience, but it maybe wasn't as large as, you know, it could have been if he had been market-driven and focused on those markets. And, you know, he wasn't going to do that because he had integrity. And so I think it's the same with this, you know, this music is, I mean, Christians would hear it and think, well, what's Christian about that music? You know?
Yeah.
And somebody who's not a believer would hear it and think, well, that's, there's something going on there spiritual, you know. I don't know if I care about that or not.
Mm-hmm.
So there is all of that. So I think that's why maybe it's the best music you never heard.
Yeah, and never. Some of those songs literally killed me, and they were so good and so thoughtful and so heart-piercing in many ways. And I couldn't help but think, if more people had a chance to hear this, I think it would be different. But why is that? Why is that so frustrating? That to me is very frustrating, because it's like the stuff with the most integrity is the stuff that doesn't get heard enough.
Right, right. Part of that is the way things are marketed, and the way that radio is. You know, radio was back then, it was a big deal back then. And it was very difficult to get radio play because of the narrow range of music that they played. And so, you know, we couldn't really break into that. You know, it's different nowadays. I mean, you have the internet, we had the internet, but it was sort of early on. But now, you know, we have an opposite problem. There's so much music out there.
Yeah, that's true.
That there's just a lot of noise, and it's hard to figure out, well, what to listen to. There's so much, and so we are dependent upon, you know, gatekeepers, sort of curators of music now to tell us what's good. And so but there's so much, and that's what makes it so difficult as well. But I think it's a little bit, it's easier now than it was back then, because we're not dependent on radio.
That's
and
true.
Can go, you know, get it out on the internet, you know, for sure. But
what?
You know, I wish it had found a larger audience, but it just didn't, you know. But that music is still good, and it's still out there. The same kind of artists are still out there making music.
We're playing a lot of it on our Music That Matters radio. So and I love it. I love it because it just holds up so well in the mix that we have. And people are going to go, what was that? You know, and that's why I like it so much. What do you know about most of those artists? Are they still going strong?
Well, you know, I think all of them still play music, but they're really not like putting out records, most of them, you know, with some exceptions. The ones I thought of that were exceptions were, and you'll know, Phil Madeira and Terry Scott Taylor, who were fixtures in, you know, contemporary Christian music and go back a long ways. Well, they're still very, very productive musicians. Aaron Sprinkle, a younger guy, very productive. And Jan Christ is still making music herself. So they're still out there. Others, you know, I don't think are actively, you know, touring, making music, you know, but I'm sure they're playing, you know. How could they not? You know, so they're still there. So, you know, and tragically, one of our artists, you'll know, Matt Alton, died. His life was cut short, and tragically. But a number of these artists are out there still making music.
Are you still finding this kind of music, you know, are you discovering more of it?
Yes, in a way, and in a way I've sort of moved on, I guess. I had a lot of involvement in that folk music scene back then, and I still do like singer-songwriters and gravitate toward them. But then I kind of, towards the end of Silent Planet, we had an imprint called the Pop Collective. And so we were interested in what was then called power pop music. And so Jeffrey Foskett was the release that we put out.
Oh, yeah.
Stars in the Sand, Jeffrey Foskett. Foskett was the music director for Brian Wilson and his tours.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very much a very hooky, very power pop kind of music, pop, you know, oriented. And so that was really, I was wanting something fresh. You know, I guess I was My son always told me that all your music is melancholy, you know. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm just a sad old man, you know. But but I wanted something that was upbeat, and so I started listening to more of that kind of music. And nowadays, I find it very challenging to find music that I really enjoy listening to.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I go back and I listen to some of the older things that are still out there, you know, and revisit those. But yeah, I think it's still out there. There's still singer-songwriters that are out there making that kind of music. And well, Pierce Pettis, for example, is still playing music. Had a recent release within the last year, a new record release, and it's I mean, he's right in the wheelhouse of that kind of music that I think is so wonderful.
Yeah,
definitely one of those.
Okay, so now I think you've retired from the legal business. Is that right, Steve?
I have. I'm still a lawyer. Yeah. I still have my law license, but I'm not actively practicing at this point.
Yeah, but I know one of the things you're doing is you are writing more, and you're writing for World Magazine. How did that come about? And actually, tell us a little bit about World Magazine.
Sure,
I'm not
sure
our listeners even know about it.
Sure. Well, I always tell people that, you know, I'm privileged because I worked for 34 years for the United States Attorney's Office, which is a litigating arm of the federal government. And the office I worked for was a fantastic place to work, and I loved working there. So it was my first career and the only one I'd had until now. And now I get to work not as a paid staff member, but as a correspondent. I write for World Magazine. I can't think of a better second place or second career to be in to be able to write. And so, you know, being retired, I'm able to, you know, do it now. Don't have to have quite as much income to survive. And so, writing for World has been a great gig for me. I've done it for this whole year, every week. And I write for World Digital, so the digital part of it. I have written for the magazine a couple of times, two or three times, but mostly for the digital part this year. And I'm writing on religious liberty and free speech issues every week for them, which is a different kind of writing for me. And so I've had some wonderful editors that I've had to learn from to be able to do that, you know, because I'm used to writing persuasive briefs, you know, for legal arguments.
Oh, yeah.
I've written a lot of essays, you know. I have a blog, outwalking.net, where I've written more essay kind of writings over the years. But this is different, you know, writing for journalistic writing is quite different. So I have had a lot to learn in that respect, but you're never too old to learn. And so I've enjoyed that. But anyway, just a little bit about World. You know, World's been around since, well, since about the late 80s or early 90s. I can't remember the exact year, but I was a subscriber to the very first issue back then.
Wow.
And what I liked about World was what I liked about this older magazine called Eternity Magazine, which you may remember.
Oh, I remember Eternity, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's been gone a long time, but, you know, World says it's biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. And so I like that that phrase, what they try to do. So they try to, they're upfront about the fact that, you know, hey, part of why our perspective on things is framed by the Bible. Not that we have all the answers or that we always know how all the biblical principles apply to every issue, but, you know, that informs what we do. And within that framework, we try to be as objective as we can be about the issues that we confront. They probably lean, conservative in terms of political, but not in any kind of knee-jerk sense. And then there's some issues about which, you know, it's probably conservatives and liberals would not necessarily be happy with them about. Like, for example, immigration. They wouldn't come across as some of the conservative magazines you might read. Nor would they come across as some of the liberal magazines. So, I mean, I think they try to walk that line and try to be as objective as possible within that framework. And I've always liked that. They gave me an opportunity because they think that that older people can have second careers and can actually come and write for them. You know, a lot of times you get to be an older person and, you know, who wants you to work for them anymore?
Yeah.
The world does a mid-career journalism course where they actually invite, you know, people in, who want second careers who are older to come to this. You spend a week with Marvin and Susan Olasky in their home in Austin, Texas, and you learn sort of it's not an easy week. You do a lot of writing. There's a lot of group critique, and when you finish that, you might have an opportunity to write for World, which is what I did. I just raised my hand. They said, we need somebody to write about religious liberty issues, and my hand was in the air before I realized what I was doing and what I'd committed to. And it's been great, though. And so I've been doing that and written a couple of other things. So it's been a pleasure to be able to do that. Do it every week and be on that deadline, that schedule. That's been quite quite interesting to be on a deadline like that, but very helpful for somebody who's come out of another job and is retired from that work and needs the discipline of a deadline, and I need that. It's not the only kind of writing I want to do, and I write for them as a correspondent, not as an employee, but I love writing for them. I love working with them, and I love their vision for, you know, what they're doing, so I'm really pleased to be there.
That's great. I want to get your take on religious liberty a little bit. We've talked about that on our show, and actually we've had Oz Guinness a couple times, and I'm very fascinated about his book about the global public square. I don't know that you are familiar with that one, but that book is all about religious liberty, and yet it's liberty for all faiths and none, you know, is what he talks about.
That's right.
I found that very refreshing after hearing so much from the Christian subculture, which is kind of screaming our way. It's our way or the highway. Our's way is the only way. This whole idea of, if we're going to be in the public square, we got to give everybody a chance. And if we want to have a chance and we want people to respect our opportunity to talk about the truth, we have to respect them and their opportunity as well. Is that what we're talking about when you talk about religious liberty?
Yeah, that's exactly right, John. I mean, if it's not religious liberty, unless it's religious liberty for all, you know. So, you know, what I look at these religious liberty cases, the best of these cases are about is preserving a place in the public square for religion, for religious people. And also, because that's an important voice to be heard, and also preserving sort of the institutional autonomy of religious institutions, whether it's the church or a Christian school or a Mormon school or a Muslim school, you know, whatever it is, they have their own autonomy in a sense that needs to be preserved, or else they can't be who they are, you know, if they can't preserve that autonomy. I'll give you an example from something I wrote about for World this week, and this is just a very simple example, but you know, most of your listeners, and you'll be familiar with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. So it's a historic, you know, Christian group that works, you know, with athletes in high schools, you know, they have these huddles or clubs in these high schools. And so what had happened in Bozeman, Montana, was that this club, which had existed on campus there for 5 years, came under – there were some girls in the school who were not members of FCA who went to the school board and basically said FCA's stance on marriage, which is that they believed in biblical marriage between one man and one woman, makes us uncomfortable, and we don't think they should be a recognized student group. And if you're not a recognized student group, then you can't have your announcements read. You can't post your posters without a label that says basically you're not endorsed as a student group. And So it just made them uncomfortable. You know, well, FCA requires their adult leaders to believe these things, but FCA has always been open to any student who wants to come. In fact, they want any student to come. They're very welcoming in that way, like a lot of Christian groups. But, you know, that kind of thing is a really a way of silencing, not safeguarding sort of the institutional integrity of that group, which generally used to not be a problem. You know, whether it was, and they could be any kind of group, but that group should be able to have leaders that agree with the principles of that group. And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Or it could be, you know, wrote an article about Brigham Young University and how some scientific associations wouldn't list their job postings because of Brigham Young's policy that, you know, basically that, you know, homosexual practice was not something that could occur at the school, you know. And so, you know, and that they believed in the you know, traditional marriage between one man and one woman. So those were issues of institutional integrity, you know. So those institutions can be preserved in that way. And what it does is it preserves diverse voices in society so that, you know, we can get lots of different input in society and we're not just a homogenous sort of society. Mm. So I think that, so what I'm saying is religious liberty has to be religious liberty for all, and it has to be not just on an individual level, but it has to be also on an institutional level where you have a diversity of institutions in society. Some of this goes back to a lot of Dutch reform thinking, like people like Abraham Kuyper and Herman Duiveert and these folks who talked about, you know, these different spheres of society like family and education that need to have some integrity and with non-interference by government, you know, to exist. And it makes for a richer society. It really, it really does. But wow. It's kind of helpful that Christians are not a favored group in society anymore, because it helps them understand better. I think it helps them not say, well, it's our way or the highway, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's you know, when they're not in the majority, and it helps them understand better who they are, you know. And so I think that's helpful. The other thing that I think is helpful is a lot of our, you know, groupings in society now, because of the breakdown of the family and the breakdown of community, like the church or synagogue, a lot of the breakdown of religion is in a lot of our groups now. You know, identity politics has come about because of the breakdown of those very foundational kind of elements of society. And so it's kind of a new thing in society that, you know, you get in this identity group, whatever it is, and then it's usually defined by victimhood, that, you know, we're victims of something, you know, whether it's abuse or, you know, we're members of this particular community that are disfavored or whatever, you know, it's defined by victimhood. And then, you know, they put up the walls and then they lob grenades at others. And so there's a lack of civility because of that, rather than saying, hey, here's what we all have in common. And Christians can fall into this too, and particularly if they're not favored. We could say, oh, now we're victims and we put up walls. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. You know, we in the church need to have this integrity about our fidelity to the Lord and fidelity to Scripture. So there's some exclusivity there. You know, we're saying these things are true and really not negotiable, but our walls are porous. You know, we're passing through and going out into society, and we're saying, hey, you can come in. You come in and see, you know, come and see, you know, like Jesus said, taste and see what it's about. You know, if you want to be a part of what we're doing, there are some things that have to happen, you know, you have to believe in, but, you know, because it's not just you can believe whatever you want to believe, but you're welcome to come in here, and we're welcome to go out, and we should go out. And we have a lot in common with people who are not believers, and we need to stress a lot of those things that we have in common. So it's a challenging time to live in.
Boy, it is. Yeah, it is, because what I keep running into is the whole us them mentality, and it's so combative, and it doesn't need to be that way, and it's hard to get Christians to stop fighting for their way in the civil marketplace. I mean, it's almost like we want the world to be the way we believe, and it's not going to be that way. It's yet we do want to be free to be able to believe what we believe, but then we've got to let other people believe what they believe too, and it's a real challenge, isn't it?
It is a real challenge. And like I say, it's helpful that we're not, we shouldn't want to impose our way, you know. We shouldn't want to do that. It's helpful to be in the minority now and understand that, hey, that's just not going to happen anyway. You know, what it's about now is preserving the integrity of the church and what the church is. You know, we should worry about who are we, you know. Not who are they, but who are we, and be faithful in what we are. You know, one of the best books that I've read is Rosario Butterfield's The Gospel Comes with a House Key. It's a book about hospitality. Wonderful book, and she's somebody that you should talk to, John, on your show.
Yeah.
She talks about how she and her husband, who her husband's a pastor, and she and her husband in their neighborhood, which is a very diverse neighborhood, invite everybody into their home for Saturday morning for breakfast, no matter who they are. They've got a drug dealer living in the neighborhood, or they did. They've got all kinds of people, mostly non-believers. They invite them in. They have breakfast. They give them each a Bible, and they just start talking about the Bible, you know, and have this conversation. But it's a very – so their walls are very, like I say, very porous.
Mm-hmm.
People are coming in. They're going out. Yes, they understand that they're Christians. He's a pastor. But, you know, the way she came to know the Lord was that she was a lesbian. She was a like an English professor, I think, very much into, you know, LGBTQ movement.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to do an article about the church, I think, or some kind of an article. And so this pastor invited her to come to dinner at his house. And she met with them for 2 years and became good friends with him. And the pastor never asked her to come to church. But she became a believer through that process of just getting to know him. And he invited her in. And so she's taken that model, and that's what she's basically preaching in that book. Anyway, just wanted to mention that. It was such a good book. Also, John, I also thought, also thought about your book. I was just pulled it down a little while ago. What on Earth Are We Doing? A book that you wrote.
Yeah.
Quite a long time ago, and you talk in that book about Christian subculture that encourages us to see ourselves as separate from the world. And, you know, we are, in a sense, in terms of beliefs and attitudes, but not in the sense of the other things you mentioned, like how we dress, or, you know, we're very much like the world in many ways, and we can emphasize our commonality, you know.
Right.
More.
Right. What was the author of the Gospel Comes with a House Key? What was her name?
Rosario Butterfield. It's a memorable name.
Yeah.
Rosario Butterfield.
Okay. Thank you. Well,
yeah.
Steve, our time's up. We can keep going. So that's a good thing. So,
that's right. That's right. We'll come back again sometime and talk some
more. Yeah, we'll have you again another time. That's for sure. And especially since you're doing this writing for World, I think that's it's going to be interesting to see where these issues are in 2 or 3 years from now. So
yes, it will.
Yeah. So, but thank you so much for being on the show, and greetings to your good wife and family, and thanks for the moments and the good music over the years.
Oh, thanks so much, John. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Okay. All right. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you go, folks. That was Steve Patton. And a wonderful conversation about music, about the world around us, about religious liberty. Fascinating. Join us next week. We'll keep it going.